we see 4 decades, really from the middle of the 1970s until about a decade ago, of unprecedented improvements in food security, reductions in poverty. What we also see is the last decade has been seen a reversal of that.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In 2025, the International Food Policy Research Institute is 50 years old, and its 2025 Global Food Policy Report is a blockbuster. Called Lessons and Priorities for a Changing World, it runs to just under 600 pages, and it covers the last 5 decades of progress in improving the world's food systems. Also, the challenges that remain and the need for policy to keep evolving if we are going to build food systems that are healthy and sustainable. Well, today on Vox Dev Talks, I'm joined by Johan Swinnen and Puniman Menon of IFPRI. We're going to focus on agri-food resilience and value chains, covered in detail in the report and, as we will hear, vitally important to the health and livelihoods of billions of people today and, of course, in the future. So welcome to Vox Dev Talks. Welcome, Johan.
Thank you very much for having us here. We're delighted to be here with you.
I am delighted that I was able to talk to you. Welcome, Puniman.
Great to be here.
In the report, the term agri-food is everywhere. It's used very intentionally. When we talk about agri-food, what do we mean as distinct from, well, agriculture?
Well, I think the name of our institute is also the International Food Policy Research Institute. So it's very much focused on food, and agriculture is, of course, the primary producer of food, but it also produces other things such as the raw material for textiles and etc. That in itself is already the core of it. But of course, if we look at the food system as a whole, it encompasses much more than the production system itself only. And we've seen that that part between the farm and the fork has grown tremendously over the past 50 years. And so a lot of activities which are now going on to put the food on the consumer's table is not on the farm anymore, but produced or done by different parts of the value chain. I think there's a second element to it, and that is also that the interaction with other components of the food system, so things such as the environment, health, the resilience more globally, have received much more attention recently than just the production system itself. So it's an aspect in different dimensions, I would say.
Now, one of the fascinating things about the report is it does take this historical view. It does go through the full 5 decades of what has happened. So if we go back to the 1970s, there was a world food crisis. Remind us, what caused that? What progress in policy did that inspire in the decades afterwards?
Yeah, there was several factors. I mean, one important issue there was a major food price spike in global markets, and that was associated with actually a crisis in the Middle East when we had the first oil crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And this also triggered the whole review of, okay, how is the food situation in the world? It was associated with the understanding that despite significant improvements in productivity of agriculture and the growth of the food supply, a lot of people were having hunger because they couldn't afford the food despite the fact that there was more productivity and on the supply side. And that really triggered a big rethinking of how we should look at food problems in the world and what the role of policy was in changing that.
So if we then move on to the era of globalization, the liberalization in world trade in the 1990s, the 2000s, how did this affect food systems and our ability to feed the global population?
I mean, a lot of things have happened over the last 50 years. But on the one hand, if you look at the food security in the world, okay, we see 4 decades, really from the middle of the 1970s until about a decade ago, of unprecedented improvements in food security, reductions in poverty, etc. So it's a major success story. What we also see is the last decade has been seen a reversal of that. And we've seen an increase in food insecurity, increase in malnutrition. And of course, some of the roots of that didn't really start just in 2015. They go back before. But there's been major changes, I think, in our landscape looking forward. We have in the 1960s, 1970s, there was massive government control of food markets around the world. There's been a significant wave of liberalization that took place in the 1980s and 1990s. This was associated also with the increase in trade. If you look back, for example, China was very strongly government controlled, the entire economy, also the food system, until the late 1970s. There's been major liberalization of the internal food system there, and that has spread through much of East Asia and then also to other countries around the world. So it's a very different world of food systems that we have today than there were like 50 years ago.
In this different world that we have today, we need to think about the resilience of the food system. If we need more resilience in the food system, and I think we can all agree that we do, then what aspects of that food system can deliver resilience?
I think we have to look at resilience all the way across the food system, looking at resilience in terms of production systems, in terms of what's happening in markets and value chains, and also about how we really support and strengthen resilience for people, the consumers, the producers. There are some really important issues emerging in terms of the impact of climate change on food and climate change shocks on the value chains. We're doing quite a bit of research and R&D to really understand how all these things play out. For example, we're looking at solar-powered cold storage facilities in horticulture markets. We're looking at adaptive social safety nets to women in fragile and conflict-affected settings. We are looking at programs that preserve child nutrition progress in crucial areas that are affected by shocks like climate change. And so in a sense, what we are doing through the research we do is trying to understand the ways in which resilience is affected by shocks and the ways in which you can intervene and support different parts of the system. It runs end-to-end in the food system. And that means we need to find solutions at every one of those points.
One aspect of the report is that you break down, you're analytical about how the food system works and where resilience and lack of resilience might come from. The sort of frameworks you use to do that, if we are to apply them to the food system that we have today, can we use that to assess what the likely performance under stress of the food system would be? What do we learn from this?
Basically, the way to think about resilience is resilience is not a single policy. Resilience is really a set of policies, a framework mm-hmm. to approach problems. And so you can think about really having three layers. One is prevent shocks or prevent problems to occur. And so, for example, the whole approach to mitigation in the climate change area is part of that. But it can also, all the issues related to informing people about what analysis that we do really in terms of how different behavior, different policies can prevent things from occurring is really important. The second component has to do with preparing. It's basically informing people the shocks that may occur, where they will occur, how they will occur, and so people can organize themselves to deal with it. And then the third component is response. Okay, if shocks occur, so how can you respond to them? And so things like social protection programs on the consumer side, insurance systems on the producer side, there's a whole set of policies in intermediate as well. So again, you have to take it from the entire food the systems perspective to deal with it in these three different layers of resilience.
You also argue in the report that inclusiveness and equity are essential for a resilient food value chain. In what part of the food value chains do we need to think about inclusiveness and equity? Because many of us would think about it as just at the end of that chain, who gets food. You're thinking about it throughout.
At IFPRI, our work has really focused on understanding differences in how women, youth, and many other actors in the food system who may often be vulnerable or marginalized in societies, to really understand the ways in which they benefit across the food system.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we've looked at issues of women's empowerment in agriculture, in markets, in domestic spaces, and all the way to the consumption end through a lot of our work. I think there's some benefits to the ways in which we approach things in a system-wide perspective, because it means that we really look at inclusion and equity at all points in the food system. For example, you know, our work looks at interventions to support small-scale producers on the ground. There are equities in terms of the size of different types of producers in the food system, for example. We look at different types of social protection programs. Again, these have expanded in scale and complexity, but what you need is programs that can adapt and reach the most vulnerable when they most need it, right? Because you need to understand, as you mentioned earlier in our work on resilience, who's affected by shocks, in what ways, and with what depth. And then how do you tailor programs that are fundamentally targeted to equity to be able to address that? We also look at it, for example, on the agriculture production side, the issues of equity in land tenure rights between men and women. These things have big implications for who controls land, for how land is used, how it plays out in food production systems. So, you know, a lot of IFPRI's work has had equity, especially gender equity, at the heart of it. And it's been not just about shining a light on the problem, but also about identifying solutions to tackle this across the chain.
When you are thinking about measuring the resilience, the performance of food value chains, using these inclusive metrics, do we have the ways of creating these metrics, of measuring the performance of value chains? Because when it comes to our food systems, we have focused over the decades very much, for very good reasons, on efficiency.
You know, we've done lots of work on metrics, again, because one huge pillar of the work we do is on shining light on the challenges that you then need to find solutions for.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for example, one of our best known bodies of work on that intersection between metrics and equity and agriculture is the Women's Empowerment in Agriculture Index, which has gained widespread recognition, is just used all over the world now. Another is our Migration Propensity Index, which really looks at the likelihood of emigrating from places at risk. We have an Agriculture Transformation Index that is more at the policy and national level. And then today there is a new movement to look at whole country food systems performance through an index or a body of metrics called the Food Systems Countdown, which again, we've made contributions to. We work a lot with policymakers who use data, right? It's not enough that you have the data and the metrics. I think a real hallmark of how we approach data is how does it actually get used to spotlight problems, to identify areas that need action. And for us, it isn't just about the metrics. It's also about walking hand in hand with policymakers and decision makers to help them see the challenges and identify actions, which we do through really rooted policy support programs in some of the world's most vulnerable settings.
I think an important component of that is that we have now systematically started not just collecting information, but also organizing information on the food system as a whole and the different components on it. So in the past, people would often look at the share of agriculture in GDP, the share in employment, etc. We've always known, but not documented very well, the role that the off-farm components of the food system are very important in creating employment, and particularly youth employment. You see, many young people are looking for opportunities of no longer being employed in agriculture because often it's low income opportunities there or job opportunities, but engaging in different components of the food system. Often they're also in the rural area. So the social movement is easier. And so with skill development, with access to new technology, often these job opportunities are much more attractive. And you also see that in terms of development, that those activities are very attractive, create much more job opportunities for young people going forward, and therefore require more policy attention than they have received in the past, I would say, or more explicit policy attention. And so we're working together with quite a number of international organizations like the World Bank to analyze that in much more detail than we used to do in the past.
Well, if we're discussing urbanization, which has been another huge story in development in the last 50 years, there are more people are moving to cities. Do we need to do more research, pay more attention to how we are linking rural production to urban markets?
On the production side, what we see is that the distance to urban markets is a really very important determinant of productivity, of access to inputs, of the nature of the farm. Okay, you really see mm-hmm. a gradient in terms of the type of agricultural activities, how close they are to cities. Now, of course, closeness is not a given, okay? Closeness changes by urbanization itself, but also by the transport cost and information costs. And all these have changed tremendously over the past 50 years.
It's a very interesting phenomenon, right? Because you have settings where food is often rather abundant in cities. It's widely accessible. But the challenges there are really about the access to nutritious and affordable diets, especially for the urban poor. And, you know, as an institute that's really focused on what's happening to poor people around the world, we see a huge need to really understand what's happening in terms of urban diets, how they're affected by poverty, and also what kinds of solutions can come into play. The kinds of things that we typically see in programs that have been often designed with what I'm just going to call a rural bias mm-hmm. don't really work the same way in urban settings. You know, social protection doesn't work the same way. You have migrant populations, you have people who are mobile, you have very time-stressed families that are commuting long distances. And so diets and the ways in which they are shaped in urban areas can be quite different. At the same time, I think it's very interesting because urban food systems are the first to see new trends and to shape aspirations. There is this urban-rural relationship, if you will, around food aspirations and diets and how things are shaped, which we don't quite fully understand. So just a really quick example. I was out birding this past weekend, drove out about an hour and a half outside of Delhi, fairly rural area at the end of the day, and found this tiny pizza shop. You know, it said, Domino's Pizza, call us. And I'm going, this is in the middle of nowhere. But it's a sense of sort of that urban to rural reshaping of aspirations. So I think there's some very interesting things there for us to dig into. Unfortunately, doesn't get enough play in agriculture research. The people thinking about what's happening in urban areas, it's a, perhaps a different set of people. So we need to do a lot more to connect the dots there between a rural and an urban. And this is where agri-food becomes important.
One aspect of food policy, which is very salient at the moment, is how that works in conflict zones. You increasingly see access to food used as a weapon of war. What can we do to strengthen institutions to protect vulnerable people in these situations?
The numbers there are really, really worrisome. Of course, war and food have always been associated with each other. I mean, this goes mm-hmm. back thousands of years. It's really not a new thing. But if you look at the number of displaced people in the world, displaced because of conflict or fragility, that has increased very, very strongly over the last 10, 15 years. It's really tripled. So from roughly 40 million people in the world to more than 100, 120 million people right now. And it's almost like an exponential growth there. This is very strongly associated with a growth and acute food insecurity in the world. And so that is clearly contributing to the very negative development in food security in the world. And part of it is internal conflicts, and part of it is global conflicts. And of course, it is associated with weather shocks, which are increasing in the world. But there's a number of other factors, which of course also play a very important role. And some of the issues from a policy perspective have to do with how to cope with it. We often think about international migration, people from Africa migrating to Europe, for example. But most of the migrants are going to places which are also poor. So there's a lot of local issues there in terms of food security, both for the people who arrive and the people who are living there and coping with this situation.
You see the most severe forms of child malnutrition in fragile and conflict-affected settings. So things like severe wasting, which contributes to the deaths of young children. And all of that is a very here and now problem. But the historical research in nutrition, stemming all the way back to the Dutch famine, which was part of the siege that happened in World War II, what we also know is that there are very long-term implications of being affected by malnutrition in deep ways at very critical points of time, so the first 1,000 days of life. And so my worry, and I think our worry, is that, you know, as we see the expansion of conflicts, the intersection of that with the sort of pure biological vulnerability and the long-term human capital impacts of young children and pregnant women that are affected by food insecurity, I mean, we're looking at implications that are not just about the here and now. I mean, this is also about the future of humanity. Really long-term impacts. The studies of the Dutch famine, for example, still continue. And they still find impacts, lingering impacts in the DNA across generations. So really a lot to contend with in terms of what we need to be paying attention to and why we need to be paying attention to protecting vulnerable populations.
I really want to discuss a couple of those future of humanity type questions. There are huge challenges for policymakers at the moment, from macroeconomic shocks. We've seen rising inflation, currency movements, interest rates. They have translated directly through to food value chains, and policymakers are responding. What has worked well to protect access to food?
The positive lessons of the optimistic part of looking back over the last 50 years has really been what the enormous improvements in food security, reduction in poverty between the 1970s and the 2010s, really. Mm-hmm. These have been associated with better equilibrium, I would say, between public policy and private activities, private entrepreneurship. It has also been associated with very large investments in infrastructure, both domestically and internationally, and also with the international cooperation in many ways. Okay, we've seen the WTO, for example, which was created to provide a framework for international trade. A lot of these things are under, maybe threat is not the right word, but are really have not functioned all that well over the last decades. We've also seen that massive investment we've seen in public R&D, research and development, they have flattened at the global level. And in quite a few countries, they are below targets. And this has translated in the fact that we see global productivity growth in agriculture and food production leveled off. So the growth is considerably less in terms of productivity than it was a decade ago. So we need reinvestments in a lot of these things. I think the world has become a bit complacent in terms of everything looked good, so we don't need to pay that much attention to it anymore. And that's wrong. We need to pay a lot of attention again. I think also on the international level, everybody knows the issues that are on the table right now. We really need to put a lot of effort into making sure that the coordination there is there, both from the public perspective and from the private engagement, entrepreneurship, and the markets that can function well to unleash these in the right direction and not in the wrong direction.
We encounter a set of policymakers globally that recognize that some of these problems are real problems that need solutions. So they align around, for example, the value of food insecurity and malnutrition to the larger global agenda. They pay attention to it in their own context. They decide to coordinate on it. They will include it in their top dialogues and, you know, really direct financing towards the kinds of actions that we know make a difference. And for me, the other best scenarios are where we also encounter policy settings where people are cognizant that evidence can help them do a better job. That's where we come in as researchers to work with people. You can't just throw limited resources out there and hope it has an impact. You know, you have mm-hmm. to think very strategically about how am I going to use the limited resources to achieve the greatest possible impacts for the most vulnerable people? How am I going to invest in long-term resilience? How am I going to tackle root causes? These are not easy decisions when resources are very, very constrained. And so our best case scenario is really when people are engaging with the knowledge community, with the researchers, saying, tell us what the best things are that we can do here. Or we are going to innovate in these ways. Let's work together to see how well it works. But we are in a world where many problems end up being denied. And then it doesn't matter if you have the best solutions in hand. If people say food insecurity doesn't matter, well, we have a bigger job in front of us. Problem recognition, investments, and learning as we go. I think these are big, big positive stepping stones to impact for us.
Okay, so that's the best case scenarios. What are the worst case scenarios? What's bad policy at the moment?
Well, if you look, for example, at the trade arena, mm-hmm. I recall when I was a student, there was a very well-known book which is called World Markets in Disarray by D. Gale Johnson from University of Chicago. A lot of people refer to it. And at that point, it was how governments were intervening in international markets with a lot of instability in global markets. But the reason was quite different from today. At that point, it was a lot of subsidies in rich countries. It was taxation of farmers through meddling or inefficient control of exchange rates in developing countries, which really put a big tax on the poorest of these developing countries, the farmers. Over time, internationally, there's been significant reforms of these policies, so to the benefit of international trade and the way international trade had contributed to poverty reduction and food security. Right now, we see a double problem, I think. On the one hand, we see in several countries, whenever there's a price spike or an increase in food price on global markets, food exporting countries start restricting exports, so they're making things worse by increasing the prices even further. And at this point, we see the growth of tariffs again, something we thought was something of the past, but it's coming back around the world. It's clearly triggered by some of the activity in some countries. The instability has grown a lot. What COVID has learned as well is that our global food value chains have shown a remarkable amount of resilience, I would say, over in this period. So while initially we expected or we had stories of a lot of disruptions, there has been quite a lot of, I think, quite entrepreneurial responses, both in the public sector and the private sector, to make our value chains more resilient than we thought. But of course, with the current level of uncertainty, of instability on the policy side, this is not conducive to good outcomes. So we clearly have to do much better there.
For me, the worst outcomes would be rapid disruptions in aid budgets. What we've seen is we've been able to now model the impacts of that on malnutrition. There's new papers out on the impacts of that on what we might anticipate in terms of additional deaths of children. But whether those happen or not now depend on whether some of those systems can be rebuilt, whether others are going to step in. And it isn't just about aid getting delivered. You know, it is about institutions. It is whether knowledge systems can be rebuilt, whether we can encourage domestic financing for things that were otherwise financed by aid budget. So there's a lot of systems work that needs to be done if we are to avoid the worst of some of the challenges we are seeing now with the dismantling of budget. We are in this world where the trade policies that you mentioned are intersecting with deep reductions in aid budgets. And together, that's having system-wide impacts. Big things for us to pay attention to, really.
This 50-year sweep that's in the report, one thing it does show us is the huge strides that have been made in many areas. Should we look on that with satisfaction, or should we be worrying about the next 50 years, considering the challenges that you've just laid out? What do we need to know that we don't know?
Something to celebrate in the last 50 years has been the incredible building of innovation systems and research capabilities in many of the countries that did not have these, you know, new institutions that are connected regionally, increasingly interfacing and shaping the global agenda, as well as supporting local solutions. So for us as an international research organization, we are decentralized quite a bit as well. I really look forward to the next decades of how we interface with new innovation and research ecosystem to really support building the evidence that policymakers need, both for themselves in their context, but also in a way that's connected to the global knowledge ecosystem. So we are thinking about our roles in the world precisely from those perspectives, celebrating success, but also looking to a new future, if you will.
We should not diminish the major stride that humanity has made in this area of food security. But at the same time, the numbers of the last decade are really worrisome. They're really going in the wrong direction. Conflict, climate change, etc. are not giving much hope for optimism. Putin already mentioned the reduction in aid budget. I think one of the biggest challenges going forward, how can we keep up the funding from the traditional donors? How can we mobilize funding from middle-income countries? And how can we mobilize much more effective investments in the low-income countries themselves? And then how can we bring a much more effective private sector mobilization of funding into this whole thing at the same time? And we should use whatever funding we have on the public sector much more effectively than we do.
I'm looking forward to reading the 100th anniversary report in 2075. I am sure you will be two of the authors of it. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you very much, Tim. Great pleasure to be here today.
So if you want to download the report, it's called Food Policy Lessons and Priorities for a Changing World, the 2025 Global Food Policy Report. We will put a link for it in the show notes so that I don't have to read it out, just in case I get it wrong. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Yes, we're there. And if you want to listen to our past episodes, they're at voxdev.org. And if you like what you're hearing, tell someone else about it, please. And also leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.